This week in Your Health, just what does it take to convince us to do something we really don't want to do, like give up our daily can of soda or get a flu shot? Getting people to change their behavior has never been easy. In today's program, we'll hear about two approaches. One, I guess you could call the do-it-or-you'll-pay approach, and in our other story, it's the do-it-or-get-fired approach. We'll also hear about the role patients play in driving up healthcare costs, and a sweet story about a government-run healthcare program that makes at least one woman in Colorado very happy. Ask just about anybody in public health what they think of soda pop, and they'll tell you it's bad for you. They might even tell you that drinking soda is directly linked to obesity. And if that person is really on their soapbox, they'll go on and tell you that obesity is partly responsible for skyrocketing health costs. So, back to this idea of getting people to change their ways. What if the government taxed us every time we drank a soft drink? Would that work? Kelly Weiss of Capital Public Radio has this story.
The Mace Market sits in a suburb of Davis, west of Sacramento. Shiny bags of potato chips, ding-dongs, and candy bars line the shelves. And brightly lit humming refrigerators are packed with bottles of soda. Harold Goldstein is a physician and executive director of the California Center for Public Health Advocacy. He says this is ground zero.
I am seeing a whole wall of sugar here.
He's heading straight for the soda.
And let me open the refrigerator here and just see what this is. It looks like an obese bottle of Coca-Cola. It is 33.8 fluid ounces. So each of these has, if I do the math...
And the math is 28 teaspoons in that one bottle. Goldstein says it's a problem when someone consumes that much sugar.
So the science is really clear.
He says this science was detailed in an unprecedented survey done by the UCLA Center for Health Policy Research. The center interviewed more than 40,000 Californians about their soda drinking habits.
The study that we did with UCLA showed that regardless of income or ethnicity, adults who drink one or more soda a day are 27% more likely to be overweight or obese.
On average, Goldstein says Americans drink 50 gallons of soda a year. So he says we should tax it so the beverage industry pays its fair share for the obesity epidemic. The store clerk, Satnam Chima, is watching our conversation with interest. I ask him what his favorite soda is.
No, I don't drink the soda. I drink the water. I never tried soda.
But he says a lot of his customers have a different opinion, and he doesn't want to see a soda tax.
The more the tax, everything coming more tax, then everyone out of business then.
But the director of Yale's Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity, Kelly Brownell, says the tax would have a big payoff.
Using tax, much as has happened with tobacco, to try to change consumption patterns in a way that would benefit overall public health and provide a very much needed revenue for programs seems like a home run.
Brownell says a soda tax could generate a lot of money. He and several other public health experts argue this in a New England Journal of Medicine article out this month.
The list of ways you could use revenue from a soda tax is a mile long. But the best use of it would be to make healthy foods more available.
The American Beverage Association says not so fast. Spokesman Kevin Keene says you can't compare tobacco taxes and soda taxes.
You can have a soft drink and be a healthy person. You can't say the same about smoking.
Keene says he doesn't believe taxing soda and other sugar-sweetened beverages like sports and energy drinks and juices will eliminate obesity anyway. Instead, he says, people should take more responsibility for their health. And he adds, a new tax could hurt a lot of people.
We have some economic data that shows there'd be a $22 billion lost in economic output. You know, whether it's jobs, whether it's people buying less product, etc. But there's no doubt, and we can see, that it would affect sales.
Still, public health advocates like Kelly Brownell at Yale are banking on a penny-an-ounce federal soda tax. He says it could generate $150 billion in the next 10 years. Lawmakers on Capitol Hill are toying with the idea of using a soda tax to help pay for the health care overhaul. But Brownell says at this point, it's still just an idea. For NPR News, I'm Kelly Weiss in Sacramento.
For years, healthcare workers have been encouraged to get flu shots as a way to keep the virus from spreading to their patients. But still, most healthcare workers don't get the vaccine. Now, hospital and clinic workers in New York State don't have a choice. They've been told they must get a seasonal and H1N1 flu shot by the end of next month. The idea of making flu shots mandatory is catching on in other states, but many healthcare workers aren't rolling up their sleeves. Richard Knox has this story.
When it comes to flu shots, New York nurse Gemma Marie Hansen is like most U.S. healthcare workers.
I've never gotten vaccinated against the flu. I was always extremely healthy, never got the flu, and I went through 20-plus flu seasons of taking care of patients without getting it.
I don't need it is the number one reason healthcare workers give for not getting a flu shot. But this year, nurse Hansen will have to get one or wear a mask for the entire flu season. New York is the first and only state to require all workers in hospitals and clinics to get immunized against the flu, both seasonal flu and the new H1N1 virus. Dr. Gus Burkhead is New York's deputy health commissioner. For years, he's led annual campaigns to cajole workers in hospitals and nursing homes to get flu shots. It hasn't worked. New York has never gotten even 40% of its healthcare workers immunized. So this year, they're being forced to get flu shots.
I think it was really sitting around each year reviewing what had happened and all of our efforts and then being disappointed by the end result that we began to come around to this idea that some kind of a requirement was going to be needed.
Mandatory flu vaccination. It's not something that sits well with Gemma Marie Hansen and her friends.
The nurses that I've been speaking to are extremely concerned that they're not being given the information that they need to make an educated decision on whether they should be taking the seasonal flu vaccine as well as the H1N1 vaccine.
We don't really know how many healthcare workers will refuse to get the shot, but some people have very strong feelings about it.
The level of anger that we are hearing is growing, that's all I can tell you. Whether it's correct or not, people are very upset.
That's Joel Shufro of the New York Committee for Occupational Safety and Health. It's a coalition of 200 union locals. Opponents cite a number of reasons why they're against mandatory flu shots. The vaccine doesn't work very well, they say. It can cause serious side effects. And flu shots can cause the flu. Experts say that's a myth. But Shufro says the objections often come down to this point.
I think that there are a large number of people who believe that this is a matter of principle about what is being injected into their body, and they want control over that.
Dr. Joyce Lammert has heard all the arguments. She's chief of medicine at Seattle's Virginia Mason Medical Center. 4 years ago, her hospital started requiring its staff to get flu shots.
I'm passionate about it. I think it's one of the most important things that we can do for our patients. It's really very easy.
Persuading workers isn't always easy. The Seattle nurses got a judge to rule that mandatory vaccination needs to be part of union negotiations. But in the end, the objections largely faded away.
Since the first year, it's really not been a big issue. The culture's basically changed, and people just assume that it's something that we do in the fall.
Encouraged by the Seattle experience, more hospitals are starting to require flu shots. Barnes Jewish Hospital in St. Louis, Hospital Corporation of America, the nation's largest chain, MedStar Health, a network in the Washington-Baltimore area. Dr. William Thomas is MedStar's chief medical officer.
We're prepared to go through the process of letting people know that they can't work in our hospital.
So you would actually fire somebody?
Yes.
Thomas says hospitals are requiring all kinds of patient safety measures these days, frequent hand washing, preventing medication errors. Requiring flu shots is just part of all that.
Quite honestly, when I talk to people around the country, they all know we should have done this years ago. We didn't have the courage.
The courage to take on opponents. But now, when some doctors have told Thomas they don't want to get a flu shot, he just says, "Let me know the next time you go into the operating room if you don't want to scrub." Richard Knox, NPR News.
And now here's a story about you and me, the medical consumer, and the role that we have to play in driving up healthcare costs. We're not the same kind of medical consumer we were 20 years ago, and that difference is making us more expensive. Elise Spiegel has this story. These past few weeks, we've been bringing you the stories of people and their health insurance from our series, Are You Covered?
And the light in the sky was quickly fading.
Today, we travel to Colorado, where we'll meet an elderly woman who has learned a lot about Medicaid in recent years.
She walked through her empty office.
Medicaid is the federal and state funded program that helps provide health care for the poor and disabled.
After a second, a woman ran to the corner.
It also goes towards long-term care in facilities such as nursing homes.
And even though it was after hours,
NPR's Jeff Brady takes us to Flagler, Colorado. These past few weeks, we've been bringing you the stories of people and their health insurance from our series, Are You Covered?
Family practice.
Today, we travel to Colorado, where we'll meet an elderly woman who has learned a lot about Medicaid in recent years.
Helped at her wedding.
Medicaid is the federal and state-funded program that helps provide health care for the poor and disabled.
But in one important way, her practice is
completely different. It also goes towards long-term care in facilities such as nursing homes.
For modern patients.
NPR's Jeff Brady takes us to Flagler, Colorado.
And what they want.
I probably say 5 or 6 times a day, people come in saying, I looked this up on the internet, or I saw this and I wonder if I could have this.
They come in quoting commercials they've seen on TV, requesting pills and diagnostic tests, or treatments for diseases they are convinced that they have. Dr. Moore says that sometimes they're right, more often they're wrong, but she's not judgmental about their self-diagnosis. She views it as a natural response to the ocean of health information that surrounds every modern person, and relates it to her own experience as a medical student.
There is a syndrome in medical school they teach us about called medical student syndrome. And what that is the first few times you learn about certain diseases, you think you have it. So the same thing that triggers medical students to worry that they have these diseases is part of what's triggering people watching television or surfing the internet to believe they have these conditions, is that the continued re-exposure to suggestions of symptoms starts making people look for things.
The problem, says Moore, is that it can take a lot of work to convince her patients that their own diagnoses are wrong. Or anyway, her younger patients.
In the older population, there is a tremendously different dynamic between doctors and patients. There is a lot more belief and trust in the doctors in general. In patients who were typically between about 25 and 50, there is a lot more push to get what they want.
The behavior of patients in our healthcare system has changed dramatically over the last couple of decades. We've been transformed from passive patients into active and aggressive consumers of health services. Dr. Joseph Zebley is a 60-year-old family physician in Baltimore, Maryland, and he dates the beginning of this transformation to the early 90s. He says people slowly started showing up with their own research.
It was the sort of thing that would be a bit of a surprise, and it would be the occasional patient. By 95, it was an established pattern. It became a palpable change over the period of about 5 years.
What produced this change was a kind of perfect storm of events. The first was direct-to-consumer advertising of prescription medications, which started on TV in the mid-80s. Those ads drove people to their doctor asking about particular drugs, and in the process taught patients that they could play more of a role in their own health care. Then, obviously, there was the internet. And finally, there was the attempt in the 1990s to save money on health care by pushing people into HMOs. The original idea was that primary care physicians would be put in charge of patients and given a fixed amount of money for all care, which would give the doctor an incentive to improve the overall health of the patient, because the healthier the patient, the more money the doctor could keep. The system, however, led to more denials of tests and operations, which Zebley says was shocking to patients.
And they became angry and they started researching why they should get things, because oftentimes the physicians, hate to say it, but the physicians were looking after their bottom line, and if they withheld services, they could make more money. So a person went online, it was very rudimentary then, or looked things up in the library, and people photocopied things from the library and say, I think I have this, I think I need this.
Now, there are real benefits to this new American patient, but also some problems. For one, we cost a lot of money. You see, under the current system, it's just really hard for doctors to say no to our requests, even when they're wrong-headed. For example, Zebley tells me that several times a week, a patient comes in asking for a test that he, as a doctor, is 99% sure would be a complete waste of time. But does he give it? Absolutely. Because of malpractice.
I'm in a position of risk if I blow them off and say, no, forget it, you don't have it, I'm not doing the test.
Of course, Zebley could take the time to argue his patients out of it, explain exactly why the test or treatment is a bad idea. But because of the way our health system is structured, that's often difficult too. Take Dr. Teresa Moore. She works incredibly hard to spend enough time with her patients, but says time is always limited.
There is a drive to get people in and out because insurance reimbursement is very difficult. And so even though it is absolutely wonderful to say we could spend 30 minutes with each patient and explain these things fully, sometimes you just don't get to do that in real life.
And so doctors will order you tests that you don't need, give you pills you probably shouldn't take. That's a huge problem with antibiotics. Zebley says doctors even do operations, stuff like back surgery, they probably shouldn't do. They do it, he says, partly because you want it, have become convinced that you need it, and they fear that if they don't give it to you, they'll lose you.
The orthopedic surgeon would be ill-advised to say, well, I'm not going to do it, because the person will go next door to the other surgeon, who may be a little less ethical, who will do it. And being a hard ass and always saying no, 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 people will go somewhere else.
Experts estimate that anywhere from 10 to 20% of healthcare costs are driven by patients in this way. Teresa Moore says it feels more like 30% of her own practice, but she's not happy with that number. For her, at least some portion of it is an indication of her own inability to adequately communicate with the patients she cares so much about. It's just, she says, that she is truly overwhelmed by insurance paperwork.
Sometimes you have to request a form to get the correct form. You know, you have to fill out a form stating the pre-authorization form that you need.
As Dr. Moore talks about this, she actually gets emotional.
I just really want to do right by every one of my patients. And I want to be able to spend the time it takes to educate them.
Do you feel like you're not able to, really?
I feel like my children suffer because I spend so much time with my patients. I stay here a lot of times till 10 and 11 o'clock at night, trying to catch up on the paperwork. So I'm able to spend the time with the patients in the office.
Still, if you ask Teresa Moore if she'd rather have the old, passive patient or the new, demanding one, she really has to think about it.
It depends on the phase of the moon. No, passive's much easier to treat. I do think I like a more educated patient who's willing to read about their health issues and who wants to learn about them.
Dr. Joseph Zebley says the same, though he knows full well how our new conception of what it means to be a patient cost society.
You know, you must demand of your doctor this, you must ask them all these questions, you must be a wise, intelligent, informed consumer, which is all true, it's all good, but it leads to a lot of overuse of services. We have an infinity of need.
An infinity of need that grows more infinite all the time. Elise Spiegel, NPR News, Washington. These past few weeks, we've been bringing you the stories of people and their health insurance from our series, Are You Covered? Today, we travel to Colorado, where we'll meet an elderly woman who has learned a lot about Medicaid in recent years. Medicaid is the federal and state-funded program that helps provide health care for the poor and disabled. It also goes towards long-term care in facilities such as nursing homes. NPR's Jeff Brady takes us to Flagler, Colorado. And
Lila
that's
Peterson's
all for Your Health,
the
a podcast brought to you
store,
by the Health Desk here at National Public Radio. Join us again next week. I'm Rebecca Davis,
items.
And thanks for listening.
Yeah, we've been referred to as the Flagler Walmart.
In this small town of 600 people, Peterson considers her business as much community service as profit-making enterprise. Still, she has bills to pay, like the monthly premium for her and her husband's HMO.
Right now, we're paying $11.50 for just two people. And I don't have a choice. I have to pay that because no other insurance company will take us.
Peterson and her husband are in their 50s. There are some pre-existing conditions, such as her husband's diabetes. It feels to her like their health care options are limited. Politically, Peterson says she typically votes Republican, but last year she picked President Obama, and she's excited about efforts to overhaul health care in the U.S. While she's frustrated with the cost of her own coverage, she's very satisfied with the care her mother receives under Medicaid. That's the government program for the poorest and most in need.
Hello.
How are you?
Pretty good.
Several times a week, Leela makes the 30-mile drive to Hugo, Colorado, to visit her mother, 94-year-old Gracie Scarrow.
This is a double room. She has all of her stuffed animals that she wins at bingo. And then she likes her dolls and the flowers.
I like to kind of pick along on that.
Oh, so you have a keyboard here, it looks like.
Yes.
Scarrow apologizes for her shaky hand, but says playing the keyboard helps pass the time. She came here nearly 4 years ago after an incident at home.
Well, I have congestive heart failure, and I guess I did pass out one night, and I had a heart pill in my hand, but I didn't take it.
Peterson says her mom couldn't afford the nursing home on her own. She had Social Security income of $600 a month and cleared only $3,500 from the sale of her house. So a doctor suggested they apply for Medicaid.
And at that point, there probably was not a choice of what you had to do.
Well, I just wasn't able to work.
Medicaid pays the $80,000 a year bill for Scarrow's care. She's left with about $50 of her Social Security check each month for spending money. Colorado has almost 500,000 people on Medicaid. That number went up more than 10% in the last year alone, thanks in large part to the poor economy. The federal government typically splits the cost of Medicaid with Colorado, though with the recent stimulus money, the federal government is picking up a larger share now. Even with that help, Colorado's governor was forced to trim payments to doctors and hospitals to help fill the state's budget gap. Peterson says at first her mom was embarrassed about accepting government help because she's always been independent and supported herself. Much of her work life was spent in facilities like this one as a nurse's assistant.
Mom worked in an era when health care was what it was called. It was called care, kindness and care. In today's world, health care is money.
Peterson believes the healthcare system in the U.S. needs fixing. She doesn't have a specific solution, but she does support things like tort reform and tighter regulation for insurance companies. In coming months, she'll watch closely to see what solutions policymakers in Washington come up with. Jeff Brady, NPR News, Denver.
And that's all for Your Health, a podcast brought to you by the Health Desk here at National Public Radio. Join us again next week. I'm Rebecca Davis, and thanks for listening.